All right, I'll call this meeting of Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021. Please let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. We have Vice Chair Michicki, Senator Bishop, Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Rivak. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody to silence their cell phones. Welcome to Senate Resources Committee this evening. Staffing today's meeting will be my committee aide, Betty Tangeman, and our LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and our records secretary, Chris Dickrell, who is also with us online. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear an overview of our Alaska lands and waters history. I'm excited to have Dick Milius as our presenter today. While most of you already know him, for the record, Dick retired from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources in 2010 with 29 years of service. And prior to that, he served as the director of the Department of Natural Resources Division of Mining, Land, and Water. We're very appreciative of his willingness to be here today, especially on such short notice. Also, for the record, we have Marty Parsons present, DNR Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, available on the phone to assist any members with answers to questions if needed. So given the length of this presentation, we would prefer that members hold their questions until the end, where we'll have time to answer questions. If you have a burning desire, just let me know. But if you could write your questions down so that we can have a discussion at the end, that would be appreciated. Also, please know that for any unanswered questions, we can contact my office later, my committee aide, Betty Tangeman, and she can follow up at a later date. So we want to get as much out of this presentation while we have Dick here as possible. So let's get started. Please go ahead, Dick. Introduce yourself for the record and start the presentation.
Okay, Chairman Rivak, my name is Dick Milius, and I, as you mentioned in the bio, previously worked for almost 30 years for the Department of Natural Resources and have been retired for the last 10 years, but I have stayed engaged in land issues through doing trainings on the Alaska Lands Act, through Institute for the North, and various other things. So I'm pretty current on current issues and such. And can you, everybody there hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This presentation that I'm going through is something I put together for new DNR employees like many years ago, because it took me about 15 years as an employee of DNR to kind of figure out how all the pieces of Alaska's land ownership fit together. And I thought it would be useful to have a general overview. And this is actually kind of part one of two parts, because I'm only going to talk about things really up till about 1980, and I believe you have Tina Cunning speaking on Monday to talk about Anilka and some of the more things that have happened as a result of Anilka. But what my talk is going to do is kind of get you up to how we got to Anilka and also help you to understand a lot of what's in Anilka, because Anilka is based on things that happened long before Anilka passed, including going way back to territorial days, to the Statehood Act, to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and all those things had a great deal of influence on Anilka. So that's why we kind of think this overview is really important. It's a little awkward doing this by phone. I usually do this in person, and I've kind of mastered doing it on Zoom and Teams, but this is the first time I've done it by phone, and hopefully Betty and I will be able to stay in sync in terms of the slides. But first slide there, just is my title slide. And if anybody does have follow-up questions, you're welcome to email me or call me at any time. So Alaska ownership, land ownership in Alaska is very unique, and this is really important to understand, especially when you're dealing with folks from outside, whether it be Washington, D.C., other legislators and so on that are trying to compare Alaska situation to their situation, or dealing with federal folks in Washington that are proposing things that don't work in Alaska for various reasons. And these are some of the reasons why Alaska is unique. A large percent of Alaska is public land, 87%, and that's federal, state, and municipal. There's a large acreage of federal land set aside for conservation. Over 60% of the federal lands in Alaska are set aside for conservation. And the state of Alaska owns more land by far than any other state. Alaska had the most generous land grant of any state. Moving on to the next slide, Alaska land ownership is unique. The other thing that makes Alaska unique is two federal laws, the first one being the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. There is no other state that has one federal law that applies to all federal lands within its borders. And at least parts of ANILCA apply to all federal lands, for example, the subsistence provisions in Title VIII. Other parts apply to very specific units of parks and so on. But ANILCA applies in one way, shape, or form to every piece of land in Alaska, federal land in Alaska. And no other state has a comprehensive federal law like ANILCA that actually makes exceptions to nationwide federal land laws, such as the Wilderness Act. And again, Tina will talk more about that on Monday. And no other state has a comprehensive statewide land settlement with its native people, and that being the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Moving on to slide number four. And I'm not the only person that says Alaska's ownership is unique. There's been two recent Supreme Court cases dealing with John Sturgeon's use of a state-owned navigable water within the National Preserve. And there are a couple of great quotes that come out of that. This one specifically addresses the Park Service Authority, but it applies generally to all federal lands. And this is from Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts, from 2006 from the first Sturgeon case, where he said, ANILCA repeatedly recognizes that Alaska is different, and ANILCA itself carves out numerous exceptions to the Park Service Authority over federal managed preservation areas. Those Alaska-specific provisions reflect the simple truth that Alaska is often the exception, not the rule. So it's very important to understand, as I say, Alaska's land ownership is very unique. Going on to slide five here, my presentation outline will cover native use and occupancy, Russian ownership, federal ownership, Statehood Act, ANCSA, and then lead into ANILCA. And the next slide, slide six, shows just general land ownership in Alaska. If you want to get copies of this map, Department of Natural Resources actually can provide copies of this to post on your walls or whatever, but it shows in green are the federal national parks, national wildlife refuges, and national forests. The blue are state lands. The kind of brown, dark grayish color at the top is BLM, National Petroleum Reserve. The lighter tan areas are other BLM lands, and the pink are native corporation lands. And at this scale, you can't really see some of the military properties and so on that show up in municipal lands and so on. So moving on to slide seven, federal land in Alaska, 54 million acres in national parks, 77 million acres in national wildlife refuges. At the time ANILCA passed, that was, I think, about 70 or 80% of all the acreage in national wildlife refuges, because most national wildlife refuges in the lower 48 are generally pretty small tracts of land, whereas in Alaska, there are huge tracts of land that were set aside to protect large ecosystems and so on. The two national forests total 22 million acres of land. Those are actually two of the three largest national forests in the country, the Chugach and Tongass. The Tongass is the largest national forest in the country, and the Chugach, I think, is the third largest. BLM has one really unique area, as I mentioned, the National Petroleum Reserve, 23 million acres on northern Alaska, as well as 51 million acres of additional land scattered throughout Alaska. And the military has 2 million acres, which is Fort Wainwright, Fort Greeley, Fort Richardson, those kind of properties. The total amount of federal land in Alaska is 242 million acres, or 60% of all of Alaska. Moving on to slide number eight. State land, a map that was mentioned, is blue. You'll see a lot of different figures about how much land the state has, and that's partly because the state is still having land transferred to it, and at the same time, the state is transferring land out to municipalities and through land sales and so on. So the total amount of land that the state will have been granted totals about 105 million acres. And I'll explain a little bit more about how you get to 105 million as we move on here. Native corporations will eventually receive 46 million acres of land, 12% of the state. And you often will see 44 million acres, because at the time ANCSA passed, I believe that was the figure that was used. But if you look at the BLM figures, about what they actually will transfer in the end, it'll be about 46 million acres. And native allotments, other private and municipal lands, total 5 million acres, which is 1%. And when I worked at DNR, and I'm sure people still raise this issue, people say, well, why is only 1% of Alaska in private ownership? Well, first, that's not quite correct because Native Corporation land is private land, so it's really more like 13% of Alaska. But what you have to realize is Alaska is a huge state and has very few people. So in terms of per capita land ownership, Alaska is like second or third in the country in terms of per capita private land ownership. And the only other states that have larger private land ownership, I think, are North Dakota and maybe Montana, where there's large ranches and large agricultural tracts. So anyhow, just a little aside there. So why do you need to know all this history? Again, going to another one of the sturgeon cases. This is the second sturgeon case. Justice Alina Kagan wrote the court's unanimous decision in the second sturgeon decision. And if you're looking for some entertaining reading, I highly recommend this because she has a really well-written and entertaining short history of Alaska land ownership. And I took this one quote out of it, which is just kind of the importance of understanding the history, which is, as she said, we began, as Sturgeon 1 did, with a slice of Alaska history. The U.S. purchased Alaska from Russia in 1867. It thereby acquired in a single stroke 365 million acres of land, an area more than twice the size of Texas. You might think that would be enough to go around, but in the years since, the federal government, Alaskans, including Alaska Natives, has ultimately contested and resolved and contested and so on and so forth, who should own and manage that bounty. So what I'm going to be talking about is kind of those years of contesting and controversies and actions taken regarding lands in Alaska. Okay, moving on to slide 10. Before 1867, basically the Native peoples of Alaska owned most of the land in Alaska through Aboriginal title, but they did not have the concept of land ownership, the Western concept of land ownership. They did have kind of territorial areas where, this is actually a map showing Native languages, but it coincides with kind of traditional areas occupied by the different Native peoples of Alaska. And they would occasionally have little skirmishes about who. I know the Eyak and Tlingit sometimes had disputes about, for example, who kind of was, I shouldn't say owned, but whose territory included like the Cape Yakutag area and such. But again, they did not have the concept of private ownership. They did not have the Western concept of land ownership. And when the Russians came, the Russians were here for over 100 years in Alaska, but unlike the eastern United States where the colonists came with the idea of settling the land, the Russians never had an intention to settle Alaska. There were not a whole bunch of people that moved here from Russia. Basically, Russia's interest in Alaska was to extract natural resources. Furs, timber were the primary ones. They established several forts for trade, but settlement was pretty limited to areas around like Sitka, Kodiak, and so on, and their land claims were limited in terms of private ownership. Like the Russian Orthodox Church got deeds to properties and so on, but for the most part, the Russians didn't settle or establish essentially land ownership of specific parcels of land other than kind of claiming all of Alaska. So moving on to slide number 13. And Russian settlements in Alaska were limited. This is a map showing Russian settlements through 1867. You can see no settlements in northern Alaska or in the Bering Seward Peninsula, Bering Sea area, or I should say Seward Peninsula, Bering Strait area. They didn't get very far into the interior. The farthest inland was Nulato. They did explore further up the Yukon and Copper River and some of the other rivers. But you see, they were primarily coastal communities. So in 1867, Secretary of State William Seward, who was a very influential guy, I always do a little aside for Seward just because I'm from upstate New York, as is William Seward, and he was President Lincoln's most trusted advisor. He was actually part of an assassination plot when Lincoln was shot, but he survived. He was stabbed the same day that Lincoln was shot and killed, but he survived and managed to live on to negotiate the Treaty of Cession. And when the Treaty of Cession was passed, basically the federal government, the United States, said all of Alaska is federal property, with the exception of those few areas where the Russians essentially had established some sort of transfer of ownership to individuals, or the Russian Orthodox Church or whatever. And the Russians never really dealt with the native people of Alaska in terms of ownership issues. They never really claimed that they'd conquered the Alaska natives. They certainly didn't give them citizenship or anything, and they didn't give them any property rights. And so Article 3 of the Treaty of Session basically said what you see there, the uncivilized tribes would be subject to such laws and regulations as the United States from time to time adopt in regard to the aboriginal tribes of that country. So basically, there was no settlement of native land claims through Russian days or through the Treaty of Session. So this is just a map. This is slide 16, a map showing the land ceded by Russia to the United States, and it's exactly what this is actually a map from the National Archives from 1867, shows Alaska to be exactly as in 1867 to be what it is today as a state. So I think everybody learned in high school history that Alaska was referred to as Seward's Icebox, Seward's Folly, and so on. But there was a lot of interest in Alaska shortly after it was acquired from Russia, particularly by miners. There was gold discovered. As you can see, Sumdum, down near southeast, a gold discovery at Juneau, 40 Mile. And so the first federal land law that was applied to Alaska was in 1884, the District Organic Act. And that recognized, essentially extended the mining laws to Alaska, but it said those were subject to native possession of lands, a provision that nobody really quite understood and really wasn't enforced very much. And then there was a large influx of people into Alaska, the Klondike in 1897, even though that's in Canada, the miners and the prospectors came up through Alaska, through primarily through Skagway, and when they got to Klondike and found that most of the areas were already claimed, they went down the Yukon River and looked around Fairbanks and actually eventually out to Nome and found gold. Copper was discovered in Kennecott in 1900. The Homesteading Act was applied to Alaska in 1903, and the Native Allotment Act, Alaska Native Allotment Act, was passed in 1906, which allowed individual Alaska Natives to acquire up to 160 acres of land. Moving on to slide 18. Shortly after, or about the time that the U.S. acquired Alaska, there was a movement started in the country basically to set aside some of the public lands. National parks, the first national park was set aside actually 1864, Yosemite shortly after that, Yellowstone, Forest Service was established, Park Service was established in the early 1900s, and these actions were not lost on the federal government when it was looking at Alaska. And so as early as 1868, the first Federal Reserve was set aside, the Pribilof Islands, as a seal fur reserve. Fogneck Island was set aside as a forestry and fisheries reserve. The Chugach and Tongass are two of the oldest national forests. So they go back to 1907. Mount McKinley established as a national park in 1917. Katmai and Glacier Monuments, the Naval Petroleum Reserve, which is now the National Petroleum Reserve. There were a bunch of national wildlife refuges, and there were some Indian reserves, reservations set aside, and these were actions that all occurred prior to statehood. And these become significant when we start to talk about land that both the state and native corporations got. The free statehood withdrawals were largely off limits to state land selections, with the exception of the Chugach and Tongass, the 400,000 acre, which I'll talk about more in a few minutes. And they often constrain native corporation selections, particularly in parks, refuges. Those lands were closed public land laws such as mining claims, homesteading, and so on, with the exception of the national forest in the case of mining claims. And they may defeat the state's title to navigable waters, which I'll talk more about in a few minutes. And they also impact provisions of ANILCA and ANCSA, the best example being Old Mount McKinley National Park and NPRA. And I threw this slide in just because it's kind of an interesting historical aside. This is slide 21. Original 13 state sessions. And this gets at the issue of why the federal government owns land and how it creates states and how it grants its lands to states, because the 13 original states, their original colonial land claims often extended as far west as basically British territories or whatever territories existed at the time, For example, you can see on that map, Massachusetts had a land claim that went all the way to the Mississippi River. Virginia's actually went up to the northeastern part of Minnesota. And what those 13 states decided was that any of the land to the west of the Appalachian Mountains would be ceded to the federal government, and out of those, that territory, new states would be carved. And kind of how the new states would be carved was set up through the Land Ordinance of 1785, which established the public land survey system that everybody in the western states is familiar with, established townships, ranges, square mile sections. And as an incentive for states to form and a way for states to get revenue, the federal government says Section 16, one section out of the 36 sections in each township would be granted to the states in trust for public schools. And the first state that got such a grant was the state of Ohio in 1803. As new states came in, each state kind of negotiates for what the terms of its entry into the union will be. And so when California became a state in 1850, they said, well, we're drier and more mountainous than Ohio and those Midwestern states, so we should get two sections out of every township, two out of every 36. And in 1896, when Utah, I believe, was the kind of leader of this group, said, we should get four sections because we're even drier and more mountainous than California. And some states argued that they should get grants for other public purposes, prisons, and so on. And these are all referred to as trust land grants. So moving on to slide 23, the territory of Alaska received some of these grants: a school trust grant, a university grant, and a mental health grant. The mental health was the only mental health grant ever granted by the federal government, and it was because at the time all the mental health services for Alaska were out of state in Seattle or Portland, and the advocates for mental health services in Alaska said, give us some land, or give us money, I think is probably what they first asked for, but Congress said, no, we'll give you 1 million acres and you can develop that and generate revenue to provide for mental health services. Mental health parcel number one is actually where the Alaska Psychiatric Institute is located in Anchorage. And these are all trust lands, and they have to be managed for the fiduciary interests of the trust beneficiaries. And for the legislature's interest, I added this slide, which is the status of those trust land grants. In 1978, the legislature dissolved those trusts because there was a push for the state to be selling more land and transferring land to municipalities. And it also put some of those trust lands then into, for example, Chugach State Park. In the 1980s, both the university and then subsequently mental health sued and said that those land transfers had violated the trust because they were not getting the revenues from those lands, had not, in the case of land disposals or in the case of municipal entitlements, there were no revenues. Basically, the legislature had approved giving away university mental health lands without compensation to the trust. The courts ruled the state had violated those trust responsibilities and required that the trust be reconstituted, and the legislature worked with first the university and then subsequently mental health folks to reconstitute those trusts with unencumbered original trust lands and then also with other state lands not set aside for other uses. So that's how you got to have the university lands office and the mental health lands office. And it's also how they got to be, those are actually dedicated funds because those were before statehood. So they aren't subject to the dedicated funds provision. That's just the trust land office, the university land office, mental health lands office are not subject to the dedicated funds provision because of that. So going to slide 25, Alaska statehood, there's a huge amount of federal spending in Alaska during World War II. There was public services were largely provided by the federal government, including roads, a lot of the schools, and so on. And Congress said, well, how is the state going to support itself? And the advocates for statehood said, give us a large federal land grant and don't tie any strings to it, and we can use that for development and to fund state services. And so, going on to slide 26, 1958, the Statehood Act. I'm just going to take a pause here just to do a check-in to see if everybody's following me verbally all right, or I haven't lost connection or anything here. Are we doing okay at your end?
Yes, thank you. We actually do have a question. We'll just take a quick pause before we get into the Statehood Act for real quick questions. I think we have one from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. This is actually a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. It's full of information that is very useful, and I like the maps. One of the questions that I have is, I do recall, learning about the lawsuit, particularly with the mental health land, but people have talked about the university, and you mentioned a university land office. Is the university's land trust up and running? Who is managing it? And does the money get kicked out every year used for the university? Is that an active, viable, and cash flowing trust?
And Senator Rivak. We also do we have Marty Parsons on the line too as the president? So either one of you guys or both maybe could respond to that.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, this is Dick. I can respond. Yes, and yes. There is a land office. It's within the university. I think they're actually headquartered in Anchorage. I'm not sure who the person in charge is right now because I know they were not long ago recruiting for a new manager. And they do have money. They've received a fair amount of money. They received like timber parcels at Yakutaga and so on as part of the settlement. They have an active land sale program. They have land like out in McCarthy, I know, for sale and kind of scattered throughout the state. And it's a dedicated fund, and I believe most of they were using a large part of that fund to fund the, Alaska Scholars, the top 10%, I believe, of high school graduates to help pay their tuition. There is a controversy, though. The University of Alaska has always argued it should have been given a larger land grant, and it is the second smallest land grant of any, state universities, Montana State, Oregon State, and so on, received a land grant, and Alaska's was smaller than every state other than Rhode Island. But some people argue that the large statehood grant that I'm about to talk about was part of that was meant to be for the university, and the legislature over the years has passed various legislation to essentially transfer some of that state land to the university. I think there was a proposal actually in Congress to allow the university to actually use some of the statehood's entitlement to get land out of the Tongass, which did not pass the legislature. But it's kind of an issue that's been floating around for years. The problem with transferring state land to the university ran into some constitutional questions. The legislature actually did pass, I think, two bills actually passed through the legislature. One got vetoed by a previous governor and went to court. And anyhow, a long history. I probably shouldn't try to explain it all now because it could take the better part of a session to give you a whole history of the university lands. But there is a university lands office, and it's under the University of Alaska management.
Thank you, Mr. Milius. If you could please continue with the presentation. Actually, do we have any other questions? No? Oh, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I do, Mr. Milius. We talked about transfer issues earlier, and if there's another section where you're going to talk about dates, timing on the remaining state land transfers, I'm curious about that. What's holding it up and what the expected schedule looks like? So if it's later on in the presentation, I could wait. If not, you talked about it in the last section.
Senator McKinnon. Through the chair, I do specifically address that in a couple places once we get into the Statehood Act, and actually at the end I'll give you a recap of where all the entitlements remain.
Thank you, sir. Please continue.
Okay, moving on to slide 27. So, the Statehood Act, this is where, like I mentioned at the beginning, there's often confusion about how many acres the state has, and people say, 103,250,000 acres, which is what was in the Statehood Act. But that doesn't include the million acres that mental health got, the university grant, and then there are actually some subsequent changes that increase the state's entitlement, including the Cook Inlet Land Exchange, which I won't get into that except to say that it increased the state's entitlement by about 500,000 acres. Anyhow, there was two sections of the Statehood Act that granted lands to the state. One was the community grant, Section 6A, which was a small grant of 400,000 acres out of the National Forest and 400,000 acres out of BLM. I'll talk a little bit about the National Forest specifically in a minute. And then the general grant, the big grant, an area the size of the state of California, which was 102,500,000 acres from BLM land. And so that would exclude those lands, those pre-statehood withdrawals that I talked about earlier were off limits to the Mount McKinley's, the NPRA, the Arctic Refuge, and so on. Section 6M of the Statehood Act applied to Submerged Lands Act. School asked, and I'll talk more about that. And Section 4 of the Statehood Act acknowledges that there were native land rights that were unresolved at the time that the Statehood Act passed. So moving on to slide 28, there were a couple of unique provisions of Alaska's land grant that differed from any other state. The first one being that Alaska was able to select its lands. It wasn't that most, or I think all the other state grants, other state grants, were specific sections of lands. Like there were six and 16s originally, then 16 and 36, and then 16 and 33. And Alaska was able to select from any vacant and unappropriated federal land, which was most of the BLM and Forest Service land in the state at the time, although the Forest Service was limited to the 400,000 acres. Alaska was also given 25 years to file those land selections, but that was actually amended to 35 years in Anilka, and that was because of the D2 debates you'll hear more about today and with Tina's discussion, as well as just the native land claims, which basically made it impossible to meet that 25-year deadline. And they are not trust lands. Moving on to slide 29. As I mentioned, the National Forest grants were unique in that the state was received a smaller grant of 400,000 acres out of both the Chugach and Tongass. And this had a requirement those lands had to be adjacent to established communities or suitable for prospective community centers and recreation areas. That's a quote from the Statehood Act. And there was actually litigation over defining that because the state wanted to use some of its land selections for forestry and minerals out of the Tongass, and they were rejected by the Forest Service that went to court, and through a settlement agreement, it was agreed that the state would only select for those purposes in the Statehood Act. The selections allowed the state to create most of the marine parks in Prince William Sound in southeast Alaska. But once the state gets ownership of it, this is slide 30 is a map of the southeast marine parks. I believe almost all these are on those National Forest Community Grant selections. They're generally small tracts of land, and most of the state land sales in southeast and in Prince William Sound have been on those National Forest grant lands. But once the state gets ownership of it, the state's not constrained to those purposes. The state can harvest timber off those National Forest land selections. And some of those selections ended up in the Southeast State Forest created by the legislature a few years back. And this is just a map showing the state forest parcels in Prince of Wales Island. Again, the Statehood Act constrained the purpose of the selections, but did not constrain them after the state got title to them. Another really important part of the Statehood Act is Section 6I, which said that all statehood land grants will include minerals, but requires the state to reserve minerals in any sales or other disposals. Actually, what it says is the state can never dispose of the mineral estate through a sale or a disposal. And so as a result, whenever the state sells land or transfers lands like to municipalities, there is a mineral reservation to the state under Alaska Statute 3805-125, which basically says the state is retaining the mineral rights. It's been an issue at times. It was a big issue probably almost 15, 20 years ago when the state proposed a large natural gas sale in the Mat-Su Valley, mostly Susitna Valley, I guess, really. And all these property owners says, what? I mean, I don't own the minerals under my land. And so anyhow, it can become an issue, particularly where the state sold the land or transferred it to municipalities. And this is also why state mining claims can never get a patent, which you can under the federal law, at least in theory, although I don't think anybody, hardly anybody's received a federal mining patent for quite a few years. But that's a whole other issue. And it needs to be dealt with. The state needs to retain the minerals and land exchanges, which complicates land exchanges dealing with native corporations where the regional corporations on the subsurface. I'll actually talk a bit more about ANCSA in a few minutes here. So This gets at part of the question Senator McKitchie asked, which is the status of state land grants. The state's received about 100 million acres to date. 69 million acres are patented or surveyed to the state, with 31 million acres tentatively approved. The Alaska Lands Act actually confirmed the tentative approval is title, but it just means those lands haven't been surveyed. And that's really a workload issue for the BLM. And actually, Marty or somebody can speak to, there's some current issues where BLM has proposed kind of cutting some of the corners of survey that the state disagrees with, because the state argues that that's a federal responsibility to adequately survey the land before they actually issue the patents. But anyhow, but the state, out of 105 million acres, has received 100 million acres. And so you say, well, what is the rest of it? And that leads us to slide 34, which is there actually was a book put out by a historian for DNR quite a few years ago called The Promised Land. And the last 5 million acres, as I mentioned, the state's received about 100 million acres. The university school and mental health grants are largely fulfilled, not entirely, at least. Actually, the school grant is fulfilled entirely, but the university, I think, is still on a handful of acres in mental health. I know at least one parcel of mental health was supposed to get withheld up in litigation. But anyhow, the remaining 5 million acres, the state under ANILCA is able to what's called top file on lands currently not available because of an administrative federal withdrawal. And one of those is the pipeline corridor that follows the Dalton Highway and translates the pipeline from the Yukon River basically up to the kind of southern end of the North Slope. And that's about 2 million acres that the state has kind of coveted forever. But because of that federal withdrawal, it can't get it. BLM actually issued a land use plan just about a month ago that actually proposes to revoke that withdrawal. It's only a draft plan, though, and subject to public comment. That's going to be one of the big issues dealt with in that plan. I think Marty could correct me, but I believe that they've narrowed down the amount of acres the state really wants in that corridor to less than 2 million acres. But basically, the state's holding on to some of its entitlements specifically to get that parcel of land because it's more valuable than some piece of tundra that the state could get out in western Alaska. Similarly, there's about 1 million acres that the state's kind of holding because there's various in-holdings, particularly mining claims. There's a lot of miners who have federal claims that would prefer to operate under state claims, and there's actually a process that's used between BLM and the state and the miners to transfer some of those in-holdings. They're basically in-holdings. The mining claims, federal mining claims, would have been excluded when the land was transferred to the state, and so they're in-holdings. And then until all the angst of land is surveyed, there's various chunks of land, often close to communities and so on, that the state could get, but they can't get those until the angst of lands are all conveyed, and that's essentially a survey issue, resolving all the final angst of conveyances. So, and then the other reason not shown on this slide is that the state also has selections of top filings on some of the military lands, such as Fort Richardson, Fort Wainwright, and the state can hold those selections in place for 50 or 100 years if it wants, in case the federal government ever surpluses any of those properties. And so it's probably, again, worth holding on to some of the state's entitlement for those chunks of land rather than taking land somewhere in western, again, tundra in western Alaska, which is kind of what the remaining leftover lands are. So anyhow, moving on to slide 35. Better watch my time here a little bit. This gets into state-owned navigable waters. The state also owns about 60 to 65 million acres, and they're defined in three different categories. These are actually defined in state statutes. Shorelands are lands under inland navigable waters, such as the Susitna, Tanana, Galkana. They're acquired under the Equal Footing Doctrine, which is when the original 13 colonies became 13 states, they reached certain agreements, and every other state that enters the union comes in under equal footing with those agreements. And one of those was that the state, not the federal government, would own land under inland navigable waters. And this includes waters within conservation system units established after statehood, but it may not include waters within those units established prior to statehood. This is just, again, a little aside. John Sturgeon's case fed into the second category where he was on a state-owned water within a conservation system unit established after statehood. It was actually the Nation River, which the state actually has a court decision that says it's state-owned navigable water body, but it flows within the outer boundaries of a federal park created under NILCA, and that led to that dispute. State owns the tidelands, lands under tidal influence between high tide and low tide, basically, again, under the Equal Footing Doctrine and Submerged Lands Act, and then the state also owns out to the 3-mile territorial limit. And moving on to slide 36, with navigable waters, one of the big issues is the state acquired title to those at 1959, but there's no list of what they are, and there's disagreement about what is navigable. Moving on to slide 37, just a quick note here to mention that we're talking about what's called title for navigability purposes, which means who owns the bed of the navigable waters. It's basically been defined by over 150 years of federal court cases, and it's not to be confused with navigability definitions used for the Clean Water Act and the Army Corps jurisdiction or the Coast Guard Authority. This has to do with who owns the body of water. This is kind of the landmark case that defined what navigability is, which is basically they have to be, if you look in there, susceptible of being used in their ordinary condition as highways of commerce for trade and travel. The issue of navigability could be a whole briefing in and of itself, so I'll try to be kind of concise here. But basically, the way navigability can be determined are several ways. One is through the federal courts, and the state has gone to court. The kind of landmark case the state cites is the Gulcana River, which established through federal courts that commercial rafting and susceptibility for commercial rafting and commercial uses would define navigability in Alaska. This was important because navigability is defined by at the time a state becomes a state. And if you look back, prior to Alaska, the last state that entered the Union, I think, was Arizona, like in 1914. Arizona has like 2 navigable waters in the state. So you're not going to get a lot of good federal precedents out of any of the western states. And the states that have a lot of navigable waters go back to basically days before people had motorized crafts and stuff. So Alaska was charting new ground. And I always like to throw out one of the examples that Alaska tried to assert was that floatplanes established navigability in a court case called Slop Bucket Lake. And for those familiar with rural sanitation, particularly in the past, in Alaska, you can imagine what Slap Bucket Lake was used for. But anyhow, the court said an airplane's not a boat. You don't own the bed of the lake just because airplanes can land on it. Anyhow, the state's always asserted that anything that meets the Gulcana criteria should be navigable. Sometimes federal agencies and acts of corporations disagree. And the only way you can finally resolve that is through quiet title, or if the state and federal government, the BLM, can reach agreement, the BLM will actually issue a recordable disclaimer of interest, which is an active project that the Department of Natural Resources and BLM have been working on for quite a few years. So moving on to slide 40. Recall a little while ago I talked about those pre-statehood federal withdrawals, the old Mount McKinley, the Tongass, Chugach, and so on. And it's possible that if the federal government, depending on how it defined those areas, the federal government could retain ownership of the navigable waters within those pre-stated withdrawals. And the kind of landmark case is before the U.S. Supreme Court is Utah Lake. And this is a picture of Utah Lake. And those familiar with Utah Lake, it's the second largest lake in Utah, and where Prevo is located. And it's clearly a navigable water body, but the federal government argued that it had been withdrawn at the time Utah became a state. The U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you have to make it real clear that you're including the waters and that you intended to cede the state's title to those navigable waters. Well, in Alaska, that became a big issue on the North Slope. And there was this little thing that the state thought was an island called Dinkum Sands. Dinkum Sands happened to be more than 3 miles offshore of Prudhoe Bay, the shoreline at Prudhoe Bay, so it was beyond the 3-mile state territorial limit. But the state argued it was an island, in which case there would be a 3-mile ring around it that was state lands. It just happened there happened to be a lot of oil under that, so it was worth kind of going to court to fight about whether or not Dinkum Sands was an island and whether or not the state owned that. The court said it's not an island because it turns out that Dinkum Sands emerges from the above tide or above water like a couple times a year under very unique ice and other conditions. So court said it's not an island. State doesn't own it. Federal government gets those revenues. But if you're going to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, this is a U.S. Supreme Court case, you might want to throw in some other issues. And there was an issue about the Arctic National Wildlife Range established right at statehood, whether or not that can that defeated the state's title. The boundary of the Arctic Refuge goes offshore to the Barrier Islands. So within the boundary of the refuge are what normally would be state-owned waters between the Barrier Islands and the shore. But the court said, nope, the refuge defeated the state's title. And more significantly, on contemporary issues, the same thing was true of the National Petroleum Reserve established back in, I think, 1923 or whenever by President Harding. And to kind of illustrate this, I've thrown in this map of the National Petroleum Reserve, and this shows the boundary of the reserve. And you can see that the boundary, for example, near Wainwright and near Uktagarvik, goes offshore, includes what normally would be state-owned waters, but because those are within the boundary and the Supreme Court ruled the withdrawal was meant to defeat the state's title to those, they're off limits. Similarly, if you look at that big blue blob in the right-hand, upper right-hand corner of the map, it's Teshikpuk Lake. Again, that would normally be a state-owned navigable water body. It's one of the largest lakes in the state, but because of the Supreme Court decision, the state does not own the bed of that, and so it's the federal government that decides about oil and gas leasing in Teshikpuk Lake. The state also went to court over Glacier Bay, an issue about who regulates fishing within the national former National Monument, now National Park. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled the Glacier Bay, the state pre-statehood withdrawal, did defeat the state's title. But again, if you're going all the way to the Supreme Court, these are cases that actually where the state could go directly to the Supreme Court. That's why if you look up there, it says U.S. Supreme Court, Alaska v. United States, number 128 original, which means it went originally to the Supreme Court. There was no lower court decision. And anyhow, there were some other disputes. One was these areas that were more than 3 miles offshore, kind of between islands, and who regulated those. And that was an issue that had to do with, like, where you could dump waste and so on. And then there was an issue for years. There was kind of an unspoken question about whether or not the federal government retained the marine waters of the Tongass National Forest. And for years, since statehood, basically, the state was managing those. But there were always people in the Forest Service were saying, we think those might be federal waters. But the Supreme Court affirmed a disclaimer that the federal government issued to say, no, the state owns those, to clear that up. And then that was expanded to include the inland navigable waters in the Tongass through a reportable disclaimer issue with the Stikeen River. Again, any of these things I could elaborate on forever, but move the time here. So why does this ownership of navigable waters matter? Basically, whoever owns the bed of the water for title purposes determines that state laws govern the use of the riverbed and waterway and also decides who gets the, like, the mineral rights and so on. Regardless, though, the state constitution governs public use of those waters, and private owners, in case of federal agencies, may try to restrict uses the state believes are protected by the state constitution. Anyhow, so the amount of land the state owns entitledly is about 165 million acres. Those 100 eventually will, with 105 million acres of tide uplands and about 60 to 65 million acres of tidelands, shorelands, and submerged lands. And it's equal in area to California, Oregon, Washington combined, making Alaska the second largest landowner in the United States, next to the federal government. This importance of state lands was not lost on the people that drafted our Constitution. I'm told that Alaska is the only state that has a whole article of its Constitution dedicated to natural resources. I'm sure you're familiar with the Constitution, but some of the issues that have come up in the courts and some of the disputes over lands between the state and federal government are tied to the Constitution, including the subsistence issues, which had to do with that last point on this slide 47, fish, wildlife, and waters available for common use. Requirements for public notice are in the Constitution. The ability to stake mining claims are in the Constitution and so on. Slide 48 has those things listed. Moving on to slide 49, I threw this one in just because this is an issue, again, of interest to the legislature. The state shares its land bounty with municipalities in the form of what are called municipal land entitlements. And basically, municipalities receive 10% of what's called the vacant, unappropriate, unreserved state land, which is defined in statute. And the act was passed in 1978, and the 78 Act actually granted specific acreage entitlements to the boroughs that existed at that, or municipalities that existed. I guess it was just the boroughs that existed. So, for example, the Mat-Su borough has got the most generous entitlement because there's a lot of state land in the borough. Their entitlement was 355,000 acres. Municipality of Anchorage, they never were able to receive their full entitlement because most of the big chunks of state land are in Chugat State Park or Anchorage International Airport. So they actually reached a settlement agreement in 1986. And I think there's still some outstanding state-managed, like DOT, properties that the municipality could someday get if they're surplus by the state. So anyhow, moving on, as I said, the state was able to select what lands it got, and initially kind of was cautious, selected land around communities, and some smart geologists at DGGS, I understand they're talking to you on Friday, so you might compliment them, even though it was a gentleman that worked there in the 1960s, said we should select some land at Prudhoe Bay. So that was one of the state's earliest land selections. But then the state started to branch out and file what state selection claims near native communities, and the native communities said, oh, wait a minute. The state of Alaska's been around for 6-7 years and just filed claims to own the land right around our village. And so native communities started to file land claims. And by 1966, the Secretary of Interior said, I'm not going to give any more land to the state until we deal with this Aboriginal land claims. And in 1968, actually, 80% of Alaska was covered by those claims. 1968 was also when oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay. Well, in order to build a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to a deepwater port, you had to go a long ways across Alaska. And the entire route of any pipeline from the North Slope to either Cook Inlet or Valdez was occupied by native land claims. And you're not going to build a multi-billion dollar pipeline if you don't know who owns the land. So it was actually the discovery of Prudhoe Bay that kind of forced Congress to deal with the native claims, which resulted in the Native Claims Settlement Act being passed in 1971. And because of time, I'll kind of quickly go through some of this, but I walked through basically the key provisions of ANILCA here, or not ANILCA, ANCSA. Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. ANCSA took a different approach to how Native lands were dealt with in the lower 48. Of course, in the East, the Native people were largely just pushed off of their lands, and then they were given lands in the more central and western part of the country, and they were reservations that were held in trust by the federal government. They were not actually owned outright by the tribes. They were still federal lands. And Alaska Natives said, we want a different deal. And so what ANCSA did was it extinguished those Aboriginal land claims. Again, remember, back to the treaty of cession, they were acknowledged but that they were Native people, and there was no land agreement, though, with those folks. Statehood Act acknowledged that there were Native land rights, Native land claims, but they were unresolved. So ANCSA was the final resolution of Aboriginal land claims. And it provided land near villages for subsistence and community uses, provided economic opportunities, provided for Native ownership. They're private lands. They're not trust lands. They're not reservations. They're not tribal lands. And because Alaska Natives had essentially title to all of Aboriginal title to all of Alaska, there was $1 billion set aside basically as compensation for the lands that were not conveyed back to the Natives. ANCSA established 13 regional, 220 village corporations. I'll explain briefly what the land grants to those different groups were. The stockholders were Natives who lived in Alaska, or Alaska Natives living on the date the Act passed, 1971, and they could enroll in a regional corporation and a village corporation. They received stock, and then, there, as I said, there was $1 billion set aside as compensation for the lands not conveyed to the Natives. The regional corporations, there was a unique ownership split in terms of ANCSA land, where the regional corporation, they received the subsurface estate under the village land, with an exception thrown in there, and they received additional acreage based on a population and area formula. As a result of that, for example, Doyon received a huge land grant, making Doyon, I believe, the largest private landowner in the country. And they the total amount of surface and subsurface that the Native Regional Corporation got was 17 million acres, and then they also got the subsurface under village lands. There was also cemetery and historic sites and a 70% revenue sharing provision. Moving on to slide 57, just shows the boundaries of the regional corporations. I think everybody is familiar with those corporations. Again, you see Doyon's geographic area in terms of the state was very large, and because of their large population, large number of villages, like I said, they got a very large land grant. Village corporations received the surface estate. They were required to select lands around their villages. How much land they got was a function of their population. So the smallest villages got three townships, which was 69,000 acres. The largest, I think, that's six townships. And the Klinkahida villages in southeast received only 23,000 acres because there was a previous settlement with Klinkahida villages as a result of the formation of the Tongass National Forest. And so they received had received a monetary compensation way back. Well, not way back. I think it was through court decisions and stuff. I think their land or the compensation didn't come through to the 60s, I believe. Anyhow, the villages received about 22 million acres of land. There were also reservations that existed at the time of ANCSA, and 14 reservations, 13 were extinguished by ANCSA. The reservations had the choice of either taking fee simple title to their reservation land, receiving surface and subsurface, or getting the provision similar to other villages where they got the split estate between the regional and village corporation. And basically, those that had a large reservation where they would get a larger entitlement took that provision. So if you look at a map of Alaska and see St. Lawrence Island there, it's over 1 million acres of land. It's entirely owned by the Gamble and Savunga Native Corporations, jointly owned by them. Similarly, Arctic Village and Benatai had a very large reservation just south of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. They took fee simple, as did Tetlin in eastern Alaska and Elam out on the Seward Peninsula. Those that had pretty small reservations opted for the regular provisions for ANCSA villages. And one reservation, Annette Island, the Metlakatla reservation, opted out of ANCSA entirely. So, just thrown out, ANCSA 17B was a provision in ANCSA that requires access be provided across ANCSA lands to public lands and waters, whether it's state or federal. There's a lot of issues related to identifying these and managing these and so on, but I won't get into it other than say it's an important part of ANCSA for public access. And ANCSA's been amended a whole bunch of times, so if you pick up a copy of ANCSA off the shelf, make sure you know what the amendments are, because there's quite a few things in ANCSA that have changed over time. Again, I won't delve into these. So one other provision in ANCSA, though, didn't deal with native lands, dealt with federal lands. And this is a little historical perspective. Again, the 60s was kind of the environmental movement was kind of born or grew or whatever you want to say. There was the Wilderness Act. There was a huge controversy about Redwoods National Park, the first Earth Day, 1970. National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, was passed in 1970, EPA formed. And so ANCSA comes along in 1971, and Congress inserted Section 17D1 and 17D2. And 17D1 still lives with us. It allowed the Secretary of Interior to withdraw lands from entry, well, you can see what it says there, under public lands law, withdraw lands like for mineral entry, leasing, and so on, for study and classification. And many of these withdrawals are still in place. In 2004, Congress, at the urging of Senator Murkowski, passed the Alaska Lands Transfer Acceleration Act that required BLM to finally look at these withdrawals and see if some of them could go away and these lands could be made available for mineral entry or speed up the state transfers to the state of these parcels. On January 19th of this year, right before the inauguration, I will note, the Secretary of Interior revoked 9.7 million acres of these D1 withdrawals in northwest Alaska and Seward Peninsula. It was a land use plan that BLM adopted like 15 years ago that called for those revocations, but it the actual action has to be done by the Secretary of Interior, and so that's the biggest chunk of those withdrawals that have ever been revoked. So a big accomplishment. This is a map that shows those D1 withdrawals. It's a little more alarming than you might think, because most of the purple areas, which are D1 withdrawals, are actually within national parks, national wildlife refuges, and so on, so they're kind of irrelevant in a way. But the green areas are the areas that are active BLM lands where there's D1 withdrawals that could be revoked. And again, if you look on that map, this is slide 64, up in the areas numbered 4, 5, and a little bit of 7, there's some of the areas where BLM just revoked some of those withdrawals. And that kind of bright, I don't know what color you'd call it, salmon-colored, I guess, corridor in the area labeled 3 on this map is that PL 5150 Dalton Highway corridor that I mentioned that BLM's current draft plan proposes to revoke. It's not a D1 withdrawal. It's actually different. It was withdrawn for the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Anyhow, moving on to slide 65. This is the big part of ANCSA that was hugely controversial, which was 17D2, and anybody that was around in the 70s probably has heard of D2, because it allowed the Secretary of Interior to withdraw public lands from state and ANCSA corporation, regional corporation selections up to 80 million acres for study as future national interest lands. And so during the 70s, there was a huge debate in Alaska between 1971 when ANCSA was passed, 17D2, and 1980 when the Alaska Lands Act was passed, a huge debate about what lands should be permanently set aside as national interest lands. These are just some examples of the disputes that existed. The Wrangell Mountains, you know, that's where the Kennecott copper deposit, the richest copper deposit in history, is in the middle of what's now a national park, and there was a big issue. Should that area be open to mining and other uses such as timber harvest in the valleys, or should it be preserved? And ANILCA decided it should be preserved. It's now the Wrangell St. Elias National Park and preserved, the largest national park in the country. Timber production versus wilderness in Tongass, another huge dispute. There was still the large timber contracts with the two pulp mills in place in the 70s when this D2 was being debated, and there was a big push to create wilderness areas. And this is one area where ANILCA compromised and set aside a number of areas for wilderness, but it also, the ANILCA actually had a provision that required a certain amount of timber to be harvested. That's one of the compromises that became undone by the Tongass Timber Reform Act. Tina will talk more about that tomorrow, or on Monday. But anyhow, ANILCA was a lot of compromises, and the Tongass is a good example where there was significant compromises between timber issue interests and the wilderness preservation interests. And kind of one of the compromises that hasn't quite held, oil and gas on the Arctic coastal plain was an issue that Congress in 1980, when it passed ANILCA, punted on. It was a big controversy being fought about during the D2 debates, and nobody could decide what to do, so they said, well, we'll study it more and somebody else will decide. But some of the areas that were decided, there was some of the early proposals for D2 units included a national wildlife range in what today includes the Pebble site. The state argued that should be kept in state or be available for state ownership. At the time that these debates were going on, there was nobody that thought there was any mineral deposit like Pebble out there. There was some kind of encouraging geologic signs, but the Pebble deposit wasn't discovered until until the late 80s, I believe. So it was not an issue back then, but it was an issue in terms of whether that area should be retained by the federal government or it could be the state land. And then a big issue being debated was, well, if you create all these national parks, and especially people are familiar with like Yellowstone and places like that, and people were saying, well, you can't do what a lot of Alaskans like to do if you create these national parks. So anyhow, so that led to ANILCA, again, Tina's going to talk about what actually is in Anoka, but it's passed in 1980, created or expanded national parks, wildlife refuges, forests, monuments, and other federal land designations. It created an additional 106 million acres of new conservation units on federal lands, an area, again, the size of the entire state of California, actually bigger than California. And it led, resulted in protected federal lands in Alaska being a total of 137 million acres, which is those new units plus those pre-statehood and pre-ANILCA ones, 37% of the state. And it also established a large number of wilderness areas in Alaska. This is just the before and after acres of ANILCA. Before ANILCA, there was only 7.5 million acres of national parks, and after, there was 54 million acres. You can see a big change in wildlife refuges. The national forest did not grow much, but a large part of the Tongass was set aside as wilderness. I think I can't remember exactly the acreage, but a significant part of the Tongass was set aside as federally designated wilderness, where none had existed before that. There was, BLM received two conservation, they're actually not conservation system units, but two unique areas to manage, the Steis National Conservation Area and the White Mountains National Recreation Area. I think is the right names for those. You can see there at the bottom, BLM's land before ANILCA was over 200 million acres of land, and after ANILCA was 72 million acres because all those parks and wildlife refuges came out of lands that were previously managed by the Bureau of Land Management. You see a big increase in wilderness. Wild and scenic rivers went from none to the acreage isn't big, but there was a significant number. Again, Tina will talk more about that. Total amount of conservation system units, again, up to 137 million acres, or 30-some percent of Alaska's lands. ANILCA included a whole bunch of amendments to ANCSA. A lot of those were to make land adjustments based on the fact that some of the corporations didn't want their land within these new conservation system units. Remaining federal land transfers, there's about 2 million acres still left to transfer under ANCSA, 7 million acres still to be patented under ANCSA, and some of that still needs to be surveyed. As I already covered, 5 million acres still to be transferred to Alaska. The state actually has 19 million acres of selections and top filings. Top filings mean the land is currently not available for some reason because of a federal withdrawal or a competing claim. There's a lot of overlap between ANCSA selections and the state selections, but the rules as to who gets what are clear. There's not disputes. It's just a matter of kind of getting the last land surveyed. So like in a village corporation generally trumps a state selection and the regional corporation maybe not, but anyhow, the rules are all real clear, so there's not disputes so much between the state and native corporations. And the state still has about 36 million acres to have surveyed and patented to the state. There's about 250 native allotments to be transferred, and there's a whole new veteran native allotment program that just passed in 2019 that BLM is in the process of rolling out and trying to identify. Actually, that the D1 withdrawals that I mentioned earlier are one of the constraints in terms of geographic areas that can be transferred under those that allotment program. So that's revoking those withdrawals is significant for the veteran allotment program. So anyhow, it's important to understand Statehood Act, ANCSA, and how they lead up to ANILCA. And like I said, Tina will be talking a lot more about ANILCA on Monday. And with that, I'll throw it open to questions. But hopefully everybody was able to follow through that all. I know it's a lot of stuff, and it's a little hard to see how people are reacting. Hopefully I haven't put anybody to sleep there.
Yeah, no, thank you, Mr. Miley. This is a fantastic presentation, jam-packed with really worthwhile information. We really appreciate it. I had a question, or actually was just going to ask if you could just elaborate a little bit on the withdrawals, the D1 withdrawals, and you mentioned the new Dingell Act or the Alaska Native Veteran Allotment 2.0. Could you walk us through exactly what, maybe for the sake of the public, to understand exactly what you mean by those withdrawals and how that affects those native allotments?
Okay, well, the D1 withdrawals, again, they go back to ANCSA, and they were put in place to enable both the some cases they were to enable the villages to file their original land selections under ANCSA, but also to allow BLM to look at those lands and figure out if some of them should be protected or how to use them and such. And they were kind of meant to be temporary withdrawals, but they've been in place now for, I guess ANCSA is 50 years old, so they are almost 50 years old. And they prevent mining claims, and I believe they also prevent the native allotments until those withdrawals go away. And so when BLM revokes those withdrawals, then native allottees can file their claims. They haven't, BLM hasn't got to the point, I believe, where people are actually filing their native allotment claims under that act yet, because they're still kind of sorting out eligibility and all that kind of stuff. And I probably shouldn't talk any more about this because I'm getting a little bit out of my league. It's kind of a federal BLM question as to how that program is run. But it's a new program. Like I say, BLM's been working with BIA to identify who's eligible to get it and figure out what lands will be available.
Okay, so just quite basically, the administration removing the revocation of those withdrawals continues to tie up that land that otherwise would be open for the native veteran allotment. Is that true as you see it?
By not revoking those withdrawals, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes,
Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Milius, can we contact you from so Roger Pearson happens to be my father-in-law, and I have some questions for both of you that are quite detailed that I'd like to spend a little time with you both about what I see as a continuous erosion of states' rights under the Statehood Act, ANILCA, and a little bit of Native Claims Settlement Act. And I want to bounce some things off of you just for some information that's I know it's going to take hours. Is that something that you could be a resource for discussion?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And, you know, I've worked with Roger for years on we do these. For those who really want to know more about ANILCA specifically, Roger Pearson and myself and Tina Cunning and Sally Gibbert are kind of the core team that do it's normally a two-day in-person training through the Institute for the North on ANILCA. And lately we've been doing it as a four half-day online course. We have one actually later this month. And one of the purposes of that is to address the exact issue you say, which is that there's an erosion. The erosion is an erosion of knowledge of what's in the Statehood Act and ANILCA and ANCSA. And it's especially true of it's true of Alaskans, I think, as well as federal land managers and such. And every time there's a change of administration, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration in Washington, there's a whole bunch of fresh faces that have no understanding of kind of the Alaska land history and what ANILCA is all about. And like I said, that implies whether or not they're Democrats or Republicans back there. There's definitely a loss of knowledge, and as a result of that, an erosion of kind of the compromises and stuff that were reached in those past federal laws and such.
Thank you.
But yeah, I'd be happy to sit down with you and Roger.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Oh.
No. Well, thank you again. This is very informative. I think these issues are very, very important to the state, and it's good to understand what was promised to us under these throughout the history of the state, and what we should be focused on now. And so, we really appreciate this. Is really valuable information. I would also like the record to reflect, I think I forgot to mention Senator Von Imhoff's presence at the beginning of the meeting. Please let the record reflect that. I apologize for that. She has been with us here at for this committee. Thank you again, Mr. Milius.
Okay, Senator Reback and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. And like I said, that first slide has my email and phone number if you have questions. And also, if you have any other questions, give them to Betty there, and she was going to relay them to me as well.
Well, we will absolutely be in touch, and we very much look forward to working with you and others in the session to come. And with no further questions, we'll go ahead and end this meeting. For the record, our next committee meeting will be this Friday, February 5th, at which point we'll have an overview of mining from the Department of Natural Resources, Commissioner Feige and Steve Masterman, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Thank you, everyone, for your time and attention. Appreciate you being here. The meeting is now adjourned at 4:47 p.m.